Великая Октябрьская социалистическая революция стала началом
каждой социалистической революции.
Это «Аврора».
Владимир Ильич направился в Смольный, чтобы взять...
Октябрьская революция решала общие коренные...
They won't be talking about a revolution. They won't be saying they want a revolution. And the revolution will not be televised or even commemorated. There will be a parade on Red Square next week, but it won't mark the centenary of the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution. Instead, it will commemorate the 76th anniversary of a speech Joseph Stalin gave to Soviet troops on the revolution's 24th anniversary. A century ago next week, the world witnessed its first colored revolution. Its color was red, and it happened in Vladimir Putin's hometown. But Russia would rather not talk about it. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the forthcoming book, The Vody, Russia's Super Mafia, which will be published next year. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there.
And also joining us here in the studio is journalist Anna Aratunyan, author of the book, The Putin Mystique. Welcome back, Anna, 2 weeks in a row.
Hello there.
It must be my lucky week. There were a couple of things I was expecting to happen regarding the 1917 centenary. I was expecting the Kremlin to perhaps use it as a, quote, teachable moment about the dangers of revolution. I thought that maybe there'd be an attempt to bring the whites in and turn it into a celebration of national reconciliation. But it appears, at least at this point, that the regime is doing its best to ignore it almost entirely. In a thoughtful piece on the anniversary this week, Maxim Trudolubov at the Kennan Institute wrote that, quote, the revolution is modern Russia's birth certificate, but Russia does not like what it says. Mark, you commented this week that, quote, history is dangerous for a Kremlin that's used it so freely as an asset. What are your initial thoughts on the centenary and the way the Kremlin seems to be approaching it?
Well, in some ways, it's interesting, a parallel with the actual presidential elections, that when we, at a certain point, way back before the sort of Navalny bandwagon began and so forth, it looked as if there was this grand notion that the election could be a sort of virtual coronation, almost sort of making a czar out of Putin with massively high turnout and a massively high pro-Putin vote. Then, as they got closer and closer, it became real, clear that this was not something that they could just simply engineer the way they wanted. And so they moved into a separate strategy of basically trying to kind of minimize the impact as far as possible. And in some ways, I think, I mean, obviously, there's a limit to how far one can draw that parallel. But I think there is actually a similar trajectory that took place. They knew that 1917's centennial was going to be problematic for all kinds of different reasons.
But also an opportunity, I thought.
Well, yes, but again, I think it seemed like an opportunity when you're nice and distant and you feel that you are indeed the lords of creation and you can basically define exactly how it works. The thing is, at the moment, the regime is in much, much shakier a place. The communists, I mean, obviously there's no stirrings of life within the communist leadership. I mean, they are essentially, you know, as embalmed as Lenin, just a little bit more mobile. But on the other hand, the Communist Party as a whole still has a certain degree of dynamism within it. The notion of making this a kind of a grand celebration of national unity only works if both sides are willing to be unified. And the interesting thing here is actually we have a regime which has a certain degree of pressure from the left because of the, you know, evident immiseration that is hitting a lot of ordinary Russians. But at the same time, actually, it has a much shakier hold on the nationalist community, as it were, the heirs to the whites. You know, someone like, you know, Gyrkin Strelkov is in some ways, like, you know, he could easily... I mean, the very fact... It's no surprise that he's a World War I reenactor. Because in a way, his heart is still with the whites.
Right.
These are the people...
I've all along argued that Putin's heart's with the whites, but...
Oh, Putin's heart... I mean, the whites... Well, A, the whites lost, which immediately sort of excludes them from Putin's cosmology. But also, I mean, Putin is managerial. He's not heroic. His propaganda may be heroic, but Putin himself is actually a much greyer figure. And although grey is fairly close to white, It's not close enough.
I mean, there were, in fact, rumors going back a few months that the Kremlin was actively trying to bring descendants of the whites to Moscow for the celebration.
They clearly had dreams of that. You know, of at some point, that this was going to be some great pageantry that would, for once and for all, actually, you know, kill the revolution. I mean, cause that's really
that's
the
what
idea
I thought they were.
So.
That's where I thought they were going, and we were talking about this in this podcast. You know, in earlier on, they you know we were talking about maybe they're going to finally bury Lenin. Well, Kadyrov suggested that yesterday, and Peskov put the kibosh on it. Mm-hmm. Right. So, can they ignore this though? Can they ignore this? I mean, this is 100 years after the birth of modern Russia, as Max Trudolubov so aptly put it.
Well, I think, I mean, can they? I mean, who is going to hold them accountable? I think this is the point. I mean, the very fact that, I mean, for heaven's sake, oh no, we have to have a parade to commemorate the 76th
anniversary
or something.
Speech Stalin gave on the 24th anniversary.
I mean, it's not even
76 and 24 do add up to 100.
They do add up to 100. But you know, again, if you plan this, I'm sure they would have come up with something a little bit better than that. No, I mean, this is just something that they've thrown together. But again, I think at the top level, no one's going to resist it. Right. It's just at the bottom level, you know, clearly there is going to be a certain degree of, at the very least, perplexity about what on earth is going on.
And they've been commemorating that speech, which incidentally was a speech Stalin gave on November 7th, 1941 to Soviet troops as they were heading off to the front in World War II. So they can play with that. And they've been doing this on the 7th of November for a couple of years now. But I just couldn't resist the mathematics of it this year. Anna, what are your thoughts on this? I know you wrote about this week.
I'm actually considering the possibility that the decision to ignore this was not really a decision at all. It was like they were considering different options. None of them were good enough. And then finally at the end, they're like, okay, there's really nothing we can do. Let's just pretend, like maybe quietly, well, this thing will go away. We'll just not make a big fuss out of it. Because I've been hearing a lot of different stuff coming out of the Kremlin. There was, they were also considering just having an expert debate on the issue, which would have been one way out. And maybe they might still have that. I'm still at a point where, like, we could come to next week and there might be things coming up.
Well, this is another thing, because as of yet, it looks like they are ignoring it.
Well,
this is where we are on Friday, November 3rd, 2017. There's still 4 days to go. They could pop a surprise out between now and
this is
week.
The Kremlin, and we have to understand that this is how decisions are made there, because with something as big as this, maybe the issue is it's just too hard to deal with. And that's the sense I've been getting in my when I write about the legacy of Stalin, when I did the story on how different parties are dealing with the anniversary. The issue is there's a lot to integrate here. There are a lot of contradictory things that the mm-hmm. Kremlin must come to terms with. There is the revolution itself that mm-hmm. was bloody. There is the civil war that was even bloodier. There is the terror, Joseph Stalin, that is kind of anti-revolution, counter-revolution.
Or the culmination, depending on how you interpret it.
Right. There is also, in the mind of the population, and we cannot ignore this, a socialist welfare state.
Mm-hmm. Incidentally, Vedomosti had a report this week citing official government figures that 1 in 6 working Russians are not making enough to pay to provide
exactly.
their families' basic
exactly.
needs. 22 million Russians are earning less than 10,000 rubles a month. That's $172. I talked about this in the Daily Vertical this morning. It's interesting, these kind of figures coming out on the eve of the anniversary of what was supposed to be a socialist revolution.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I'm hearing a lot of this from the communists. I mean, of course they're going to play up mm-hmm. like this was a good government. We had, you know, pensions, we had salaries. But that's not really whether that's true or not is not the point. The point is this is how people feel about it. It's not just the money. It's not just the economical aspect of it. This was a time when people at least felt like there was some sort of government vision,
mm-hmm.
Even if in reality that vision had kind of collapsed and bankrupted itself towards the end of the regime. So when you're considering this anniversary and you're integrating, you're trying to integrate the good and the bad, issues that society is extremely divided about, each one of them is divisive. It's not that you can't really integrate the good and the bad. It's like every single point is an existential debate.
Yeah.
Because as we know, history in Russia is about the future.
And the present.
And the present. It's like Russia defines itself through its history. That's why it can't come to terms with it. And I think that the Kremlin's ultimate decision to ignore it, there's also the issue of its current insecurity about its own power, its fear of revolution, which is another issue.
Mm-hmm.
Any debate that is sparked by revolution will inevitably come to the present and come to the possibility of a revolution now and how to handle that. This is such an explosive issue for them that, I mean, perhaps they were looking for ways to deal with it, and they just didn't find any.
Well, I think it's worth noting that the last figure in Russian history to come to power from outside of the elite of his time, was Lenin.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, Alexei Navalny is the only figure contending, and he's from the outside. So there's these parallels. I don't want to say Navalny is Lenin, but it is. But there is that parallel.
Middle class lawyers,
exactly. Now, there's another thing I noted this week on the Daily Vertical, kind of playing off of Maxim Trudolubov's excellent piece on the Russia File blog at the Cannon Institute. There's kind of a complexity here in the history, and it's the complexity in the Putin regime's approach to the Soviet period. They want to say yes to the Soviet imperial legacy, but they don't want to say yes, of course, to its revolutionary origins. They want to say yes to the Tsarist legacy. They want to say no to the legacy of its overthrow.
They're
cherry picking, but there are these very contradictory things that are kind of wrapped up in this. Mark, what does this tell you about the way about their use of history?
Well, I mean, I've written elsewhere that I think actually, when it comes to Russia, or certainly the Kremlin, shall I say, you know, its history is scripture. First of all, it does not accept the notion that history is contested territory in a way that we do. I mean, yes, we have limits to our historic discussion, Holocaust deniers and so forth, but we expect that history is a forum and even sometimes a battleground, where different ideologies will try to make sense of the past, precisely as a way of understanding the present and the future. But that the whole point is that it is open to being questioned. What we've seen through the Putin era, particularly now with a sort of the new push towards these standardized history textbooks and so forth, is actually an attempt to recreate a homogenization. And yet to do so in an era without an ideology. I mean, this is obviously what the Communist Party did.
Mm-hmm.
But not, you know, the Communist Party had that nice, neat prism through which to interpret everything.
Right.
Wrongly, but nonetheless, at least with unity. Whereas exactly, and this is going back to the point that Anna was making, that the challenge at the moment is exactly that there is not a neat sense of who we are. Apart from the fact that we are an amazing, wonderful people run by an amazing, wonderful human being, and the world ought to recognize us. So yes, on the one hand, this is why we have seen this very deliberate program of selective memory, of remembering the bits of Russian history that work, and elevating and celebrating them and building huge statues to it and whatever, whether it's Ivan the Terrible or Peter the Great, all the way through to Stolypin, whatever. But at the same time, a willful ignorance of the gaps in between.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, that works so long as you precisely are in a position where you can actually just simply focus the discussion on what's important.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about 1917 centennial is that, firstly, it addresses the most crucial point at the moment, which is, as you said, it's the notion of revolution. It's the notion of basically moribund states and what happens to them when they fail to meet their half of the social contract. But the second thing is that it addresses it in a way which actually you don't get to pick and choose. There was there were two 1917 revolutions.
Right. They did totally ignore the February one for obvious reasons.
Exactly. Though, I mean, ironically, I mean, they could have tried something with that, because the February one is, after all, when the Tsarist monarchy sort of essentially just quietly collapsed, and you had this attempt to create a kind of a constitutional forward-looking regime, which admittedly failed.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure the thing that, that Putin wants to put out there is a law-based constitutional regime.
Except that is the language. I mean, the irony, irony enough is actually, if you look at the way that the Kremlin presents itself, it is actually very much in these very legalistic terms. And so they could have tried to appropriate that. But again, I think, you know, again, to take
it back
to
the
point,
Russian Empire fell. Not something they exactly want to celebrate.
Well, I mean, you could make the case exactly as later, but I think, again, it's going back to Anna's point, I think in some ways, exactly, it's a case of they just ended up having to just default on the status quo. I mean, for me, if you want a single image of that, it is precisely the presence of Lenin's body. There'd been all kind of discussion about moving it out, burying it and so forth, the way Lenin himself and his family had wanted after all originally. But when it comes down to it, actually doing that means taking a stand.
Mm-hmm.
It means necessarily making some people annoyed, even as you please others. And although I think they would quite like to have this kind of carbuncular construction on Red Square eliminated or repurposed, but when it came down to it, I think they just simply decided, look, we've managed to cope with the status quo, so let's just stick with that. However unsatisfactory, then actually take a stand and do something that might have a risk.
Ana, your thoughts on how this use of history and where this fits into it? Because I mean, we're going to talk about Stalin in the second half, but I think even the approach to Stalin, and we'll come to that, the contradictions that Mark you were pointing out about what they want to cherry pick are there even in the micro version there. But Ana, what are your thoughts on this?
I see this as, you know, this isn't just history. It's not just policy or a construct that's going to be manipulated by the Kremlin. This is about how people feel about themselves, their own lives. People growing up, going to kindergarten, remembering that grandfather Lenin was,
right,
when he was young and he had curly hair or something. You know, these little things that you grew up with that were basically the texture of your domestic life. And then suddenly what happens in the 90s is that this is suddenly killed. This is, like, all of a sudden it's decided this was wrong. Now, I'm just trying to describe how people feel about this. And imagine their confusion. You know, when they've got a government that's first telling them that, yes, this is good, and then that's then telling them, no, this is bad, and then once again going back and saying, no, this is good, and actually this was a geopolitical catastrophe, and actually Stalin is good, but Lenin is bad, and actually this, and actually that.
Right.
And this is the, I mean, this is essentially the fragmentation I'm talking about, because people in Russia tend to define their history by the way that the government defines it. I mean, it's very important that we're, like, all on the same page.
But yet
here,
nobody really believed it.
No, they didn't believe it, but it's like going to church. You know, you don't believe that. You don't believe there's you know, like a guy with a beard in heaven sitting on a
well,
cloud is
going
to well, some people do, and that's fine. That's okay. But a lot of people don't, and they still go to church. And it's just a kind of an organizing force in their lives. And when you're deprived of that organizing force, that starts affecting the way you feel about, you know, your general everything,
right,
your politics, your economy, your job. And I think that issue in Russia, that is the problem of history, because it's always a bloody thing that we can't really accept. And what really needs to happen, and I've heard people say this to me, like when I was working on this story, both in the Communist Party and, I mean, from, like, the consensus is we should be talking about this kind of stuff, but we're not.
No, this is, and again, Max Trudolubov made this point.
Yeah.
We should have an honest assessment of this, because this is our birth. This is who we are. Mark, you talk about history being scripture. Others have used the W term with history being weaponized. And I'm wondering, as I'm listening to this conversation and watching this unfold, is the Kremlin inadvertently turning this weapon upon itself without even realizing it right now?
I'm not sure about that. I think it's more than just
inadvertently.
They were unfortunate, from their point of view, to happen to be in power when you actually have an anniversary that naturally...
Well, hell, they could have left after Putin's second term and
yeah,
they wouldn't
exactly.
have to deal with this.
Exactly. if only they'd thought. No, I mean, I think, look, inevitably, yes, you create the instruments of your own downfall. Indeed, a Marxist would probably... Mm-hmm. Regardless as precisely creating the objective conditions for change. But yes, this is a Kremlin which has looked into history for legitimating factors. And it also just recently reflects Putin himself. I mean, we know this, that basically one of the only things that Putin reads is history.
Mm-hmm.
And he clearly has a personal interest, and especially nowadays he's more and more consumed with his notion of his own place in history. Now, in that context, we could have had a regime that basically adopted a year zero approach. I don't mean in the quite the sort of Pol Potish sense, but in the
don't
sense
give them any ideas, Mark.
in the sense that, look, yes, we've had a long and bloody road to get to this point, but that was in the past, and there's been regimes fallen. Communist crimes were the result of the communist regime. Let's look forward.
Well, that's what Yeltsin tried to do. But never
that's what Yeltsin tried to do. But precisely, I mean, but, you know, as in so many other things, Yeltsin was not great at follow through, I think it's fair to say.
It's putting it charitably, but yeah.
Whereas actually what you now have is a regime that once again says, no, history matters. And we want to very specifically connect ourselves to a whole variety of historical events. Now, not only are those events also often kind of problematic in terms of their reality, but also they're problematic in terms of the way that they have been constructed in people's minds. Again, this is going back to how people were educated. Even if you don't believe, the Communist Party position, nonetheless, you think of, for example, the Great Patriotic War as being the Great Patriotic War, and one that is inextricably linked with red flags with golden hammers and sickles fluttering above the Reichstag and Stalin's leadership and Stalingrad. I mean, even the fact that, the great battle, Stalingrad and Leningrad.
Right.
You cannot unpick what is, after all, still lived memory from these events. So although, I mean, if Putin had purely said, no, we're going to stick with Dmitry Donskoy and the Battle of Kulikovo as our kind of great narrative, nice and handily in the late 14th century, well, that would have been a purely historical event. But the history that Putin has chosen to go for is, in part, one that has been already sort of very, very carefully ideologized and also is still remembered. And therefore, he doesn't get that wonderful opportunity to define it as he chooses. So I think in this respect, yes, he is now suffering precisely from the fact that he chose to make history one of the planks of his legitimacy. And as other planks have fallen away, the social contract, that's gone.
Right.
Because, the money's all going to the Rothenbergs rather than Mr. and Mrs. Ivanov. a different Ivanov, shall I say, of Yekaterinburg or whatever. The notion of Russia as a great power, actually there is concern about what's happening in Syria or even in the Donbass and so forth. Well, so instead there is this kind of historic legacy element, but even that is actually now open to other people contesting.
Mm. Anything to add there, Anna?
In terms of Putin trying to define this history, I mean, even there, I think he's constantly jumping around back and forth between.
Well, if you look at who his hero, I mean, the people he has chosen as his kind of lodestones, his heroes, you have Stolypin, you have Nicholas I, and you have Andropov. I mean, you have, those are the big, that's the Holy Trinity.
It's a little disturbing that they're also my heroes, but never mind.
That's
we won't go there,
no
Mark. But those are his three heroes of Russian history, essentially, unless I'm missing something. I believe that we could agree.
You're probably throwing Peter the Great.
You could throw everybody. Yeah, but that's automatic. Everybody has Peter the Great.
You try to define Putin on some sort of spectrum, and you really, it's like you want to say Peter, Stolypin, but then there's a little bit of everybody mixed in there at some point. Even Lenin, whom Putin has recently denounced.
Right.
This is too visceral, too much alive. It's kind of dead and kind of alive, and really needs to, a lot like Lenin.
That's a great segue.
That's a zombie.
That's a beautiful segue. Thank you, because I did want to go to Lenin, who is dead but still on Red Square.
He's always with us.
Always with us. Let's talk a little bit about Lenin. The mausoleum, interestingly enough, will be closed on November 7th. interesting enough. Kadyrov, as I mentioned earlier, had called for Lenin to be buried once and for all. Peskov threw cold water on that in comments shortly before I came into this studio. What do we think? I mean, I'm actually half expecting to see some movement on the Lenin question after the elections, after the anniversary, after people aren't talking about this. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think probably they're regretting not having done it sooner. Mm-hmm. But yes, I think around the time of the elections, when the last thing they want to do is stir up the communists and just stir up the sort of patriotic traditionalists, shall we say, to whom, you know, you don't have to necessarily be a Marxist-Leninist to think that there's somehow something special about having Lenin there. And as I said, this is actually an interestingly risk-averse Kremlin at the moment. So yeah, I think they'll definitely wait for a while.
What about you, Olive?
I think having done what they like, having in effect ignored this, that's already taking a stand, and they're going to have to follow up on that.
Yeah,
they're basically just by their inaction, they're defining a certain course of action. Mm. I'm not quite sure how, and you know, if there's a definitive plan. I don't think there ever is one, and I really think it's pretty hard to predict the Kremlin's actions. Like every time I hear this conversation come up after the election, something's going to be done about Lenin. It never is. So they, you know, might still be able to brush it under the rug. But I mean, I think right now, 100 years and so demonstratively ignoring it, that really sets them up for, you know, after the fact, it's clear what we've done. We didn't know what we were doing, but now we know in hindsight what we did.
I can't help but recall a conversation I had with Anatoly Sobchak, the former mayor of St. Petersburg, Putin's first political mentor, father of Ksenia Sobchak, late in his life, in the late 90s, when he was kind of waxing philosophical, and he said, you know, I really believe, and this is going to sound strange and kind of mystical, but I really think Russia's going to be cursed until that body is taken off a red square. And he was, I was in the room with him, and he was deeply sincere. He was not, this was not an act for like,
these sentiments are, I mean, when I was talking earlier about how people really feel about this, I mean, we have to look at this through the prism of deep superstitions. Mm-hmm. This is an extremely superstitious society in some ways. And issues like history, like gestures that you make that would seem to have no practical significance whatsoever, are actually extremely, extremely practical, extremely visceral, and have far-reaching consequences for the economy, for the military, for everything. It's this idea: if you know a person making decisions, knowing that Lenin is where he is, is that's something that affects his thinking. I'm not talking about real magic going on here, but when there is so much history that people can't really untangle and understand, they're going to ascribe these confusing things to
No, he was, Sobchak was absolutely sincere. I mean, I was standing face to face with him, sitting face to face when he said it, and you could usually tell when somebody's spinning you with a cue. He was absolutely sincere. He said, I truly believe this. Mm-hmm. I believe we will be cursed until that body is gone. Yeah,
I mean, actually, if I can actually give you a segue to the second part of
that's
of
what
the
I
podcast.
Need. Anna gave me the segue to that, so you
because
give me another segue.
We think of Lenin's body there as being, in some ways, a connection to the revolution and to Leninism, but it's not. I mean, Lenin's widow Krupskaya, she did not want this to happen. Imagine, you know, probably they've had to nail him down to stop him revolving in his mausoleum, because Lenin himself, the idea of being turned into an embalmed secular saint would have been horrific to him. Actually, the Lenin mausoleum and the embalmed Lenin is a tribute to Stalin. And I think that's in some ways the interesting point. We shouldn't forget quite where the nexus of this curse. That's actually a symbol of Stalinism and the whole kind of creation of Marxist orthodoxy that he was involved in, and actually how he basically co-opted Lenin.
Right. No, and historians, of course, disagree whether Stalinism was a break from Leninism or a continuation in its logical culmination. I will not get into that at this point. But in a few moments, thanks for the segue, Mark, we will continue our discussion and look at Vladimir Putin's efforts this past week to address another sensitive part of the Soviet past, the legacy of Stalin. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the forthcoming book, The Vori, Russia's Super Mafia, which will be published next year. And also joining us in the studio is journalist Anna Artunyan, author of the book, The Putin Mystique. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Политические репрессии стали трагедией для всего. Это страшное прошлое. Нельзя вычеркнуть никаким оправданием, никаких оправданий этим преступлениям и этих мрачных событий.
As I noted earlier in the week on the Daily Vertical, Putin made all the right noises when he spoke at the opening of the Wall of Sorrow, a new monument to the victims of Stalinist repression. He said Russia's horrific past must not be stricken from the national memory nor justified in any way. He said we must remember the tragedy of Stalin-era repressions and their causes, and he said that this memory serves as a powerful warning to prevent their repetition. But as a group of Soviet-era dissidents pointed out in an open letter, these words rang hollow and were even hypocritical, given the reality of Putin's Russia, which is a far cry from Stalinist, but it's also far from repression-free. I'd also note that back this summer, while Putin did not justify Stalinism, he did justify Stalin and warned against an excessive demonization of the Soviet autocrat. Mark, what do you think Putin was trying to accomplish this week at the Wall of Sorrow? And was he successful?
Well, whether he was successful, I mean, again, history will tell. We will see. And clearly what he's trying to do is to defuse this centennial. And given that he's not willing to actually really address the issue of revolution directly... And given that he's not willing to address the question of Lenin's body at this stage directly, well, the third crucial element is Stalin and Stalinism. And I think one of those sort of the virtues is precisely because he's sort of chosen to position himself in such a way by cautiously denying the legitimacy of mass murder, which is, I think it would be fair to say, not a particularly controversial position.
One would hope.
While still trying to actually salvage from that Stalin, but also, again, all kinds of other elements of the Stalinist state. It's actually...
But there was no attempt to salvage at the memorial. I was speaking the truth when I said he did make all the right noises.
He did make all the right noises, but the point is, I mean, he talks about the very much he focuses on the repressions.
Mm-hmm.
As if actually the problem with Stalinism was, as it were, it was fine except for the few million people who were murdered and all the other millions who went to the gulags. I mean, I'm caricaturing that.
Of course.
But actually the point is, the issue was not the repressions. The repressions were an integral part of, you know, you could not have, there is no Stalinism without the repressions.
Just like there's no Putinism without the corruption. I mean, yeah, it's essential. It's part of the DNA. It's a feature of the system, not a bug.
So by doing this, he looks as if he's stepping forward and making a good and positive statement on what's wrong, and, you know, we must never forget the repressions and all that sort of thing, which is, I mean, good, fine. I mean, I'm certainly not for a moment saying that that's not the right thing. But the interesting thing, we still have this attempt to ring-fence that element of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to actually say, to salvage the rest of the Stalinist experience, shall we say. Mm-hmm. It makes it sound like a theme park, I know. without actually having repressions as being understood as underpinning every single aspect of that era.
I mean, I saw also this attempt to kind of fence off this in a different way, kind of pretend that repression isn't going on in Russia right now. We're not like that anymore. Okay, there's not a midnight knock on the door and people aren't being shot in the basement of Lubyanka. But, you know, whistleblowers like Sergei Magnitsky and many others can die under mysterious circumstances in prison. Alexander Litvinenko can be killed with a radioactive isotope in London. You do have repression going on right now, and you do have Boris Nemtsov can get shot within view of the Kremlin, and the person who ordered it can walk away scot-free. It's not a Stalinist repression, but I called it a hybrid repression. This week, that you
I think this worlds apart from.
Of course, it's worlds apart. I mean, but it's still repression.
I mean, again, without getting too whataboutist, I mean, all states depend on coercion, and obviously the Putin regime depends a hell of a lot more than others.
And their version of coercion is a lot more lethal than
that. Ordinary Russians seriously see in that respect a connection between the levels of coercion we see under Putinism and Stalinism. And Stalinism, it was absolutely integral to the structure in a way that it's not with Putin. Yes, of course, there are extrajudicial killings. Yes, of course, there is repression, and there are people who are afraid, which is in some ways, I think, one of the things we have to remember, that actually in many ways the terror is the terror. It's right. Not actually about the millions who go to the camp. It's also about all their families and all the people who labour under that constant shadow. I really don't see Putinism
I wouldn't draw an equivalency,
sort of comparable.
But I would say to there is,
and I doubt Putin and Putin's folk think of them. I honestly, I think that's a kind of a way of thinking about it that is a Westerner's way of looking at it. I don't know if that's a.
You mean Russians have a higher tolerance for repression than Westerners?
I just think that I don't think they would necessarily.
Anna, save us.
Anna. I can't save you from this. You sure you want to hear this?
No,
you,
I mean, I'm not drawing an equivalency. Drawing an equivalency. I'm saying it's.
Look, I mean, the scariest, one of the scariest things I've come across when talking to people about Stalin and looking, and I was doing like a lot of analysis on the dynamics of the polls of supporting Stalin. There's a lot of ambivalence about repression, but I think I'm seeing that ambivalence there precisely because even people who admire Stalin admire him for the repressions. This is very scary to conceptualize, but I think that is one area where I think Stalin support is kind of integrated around both the good and the bad. It's not, when I talk to people about Stalin, I hear a lot of, it's not attempts to justify, it's saying, it's not in spite, it's because. He made people afraid of him. He punished the wrongdoers. Now, people are sometimes too polite to say this straight out, but when they feel they're allowed to, that's what they will say. And that's a really scary sentiment to have. Putin, I think, on some level might be aware of this and is trying to play this area very carefully by separating out the repressions from Stalinism. But as Mark said, in fact, they are integral. Repression is part of Stalinism, and I think most Russians understand it as such on some deep level, and even his supporters understand it as such.
So what do you think Putin was trying to do this week?
The only thing he can do, the only when you're stuck with a legacy like this and you've got a population that still feels it needs to support a kind of like quasi-god figure like that, but at least try to separate out the bad from the good.
But he didn't have to go. He could have sent Medvedev, who would have been completely comfortable in that.
Well, this is where we're not quite sure what's going on inside his head, because I was frankly quite surprised that he went to that memorial.
So was I. I
got there a few hours after he left and talked to some people there, and it was, you know, it was raining. It was just a really powerful memorial. The fact that Putin graced it with his presence, it does lend a considerable weight to, you know, what Russia has done here.
What did you make of the open letter that the Soviet era dissidents put out?
I wouldn't diminish the importance of it. I don't really feel it was so groundbreaking. I mean, obviously, this is a state that continues to repress its citizens. I would agree with Mark that this is a completely different
situation. I would agree with Mark on that.
No, I mean like structurally, fundamentally different. Repression is, I don't think, as integral element of Putinism as repression was an integral element of Stalinism.
No, but I would say it is a systematic element.
It happens. It is happening, yes. And of course, people, especially young people I talk to at the memorial, for them, that's the most vivid thing. It's like, we're decrying repressions here, but Navalny supporters are being jailed and harassed. Mm-hmm. There's a great deal of hypocrisy, and obviously that needs to be exposed. And that's obviously happening. So, I mean, that seems to me a pretty logical process of kind of grappling with these obvious hypocrisies.
Anything, Mark?
Yeah, again, to go back to this issue of what was in it for Putin? Why was he there? And again, I mean, obviously, we don't know. One of them, I think, is obviously the historic dimension. There is the fact that, I think this was a relatively safe way in which he could show that he is part of this process of addressing the historic dimension without having to be too controversial. To say repressions are a bad thing. I think it is acceptable. If he had sent someone else, if he had sent Medvedev or whatever, again, it would have looked like he was bowing out. And I think people would still be waiting for a
statement. Not necessarily
because
nobody expected him to be there. I was surprised when I read the reports that he was going. I was like, what?
But at some point he has to weigh in on the whole. Directly, explicitly or implicitly, at some point he had to be part of the centennial. And yes, he's going to be at the parade. That's fine. But again,
yeah, of course he's going to be at the parade.
I think this was a way of, anyway, checking that box, but doing so in a relatively uncontroversial way. And one that also sort of made a nod towards the more kind of Western and liberal sensibilities.
Could I just add something to this? I think that in the last couple of months, we've been seeing a lot of attention to the fact that there is a rehabilitation of Stalin going on.
Yeah.
And that rehabilitation is coming from below. And
it's not being discouraged from above.
Oh, it's
either. Not
exactly.
I mean,
it's,
remember,
it's being
Putin
encouraged.
Saying, we should not demonize Stalin.
We should not demonize, but that is essentially a permission to keep doing this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And by giving that permission, and again, given how susceptible Russian society is to those kind of permissions and how they take that as a call to action. I think maybe what might have happened quite recently is Putin starting to recognize that this is what is starting to happen, that we're seeing these statues of Stalin going up, and this is kind of getting a little bit unsightly, and do I really want to be a part of this?
So this was his dizzy with success moment.
Yeah.
Okay. Polls are showing, if I'm not mistaken, that Stalin's popularity is at an all-time high.
Yes.
At least an all-time post-Soviet high, but I believe an all-time high, according to the recent Levada Center polls. What I wanted to do as we come towards the end is kind of pull a lot of things together. Mark, your initial comments I thought were quite interesting, where you made this parallel between managing the election and managing the anniversary. And now for this second half, we've been talking about managing the memory of Stalin. Let's bring this all together. How is the Kremlin doing it, managing all these things? I mean, it seems to me they are, again, losing their ability to manage things as well as they used to in the past.
Yeah, I think this is it. We have seen grand hopes and expectations give way to a sense of uncertainty, a sense of a lack of clear instruments, and also an uncertainty as to what direction things would take. And therefore, they kind of default to just some sort of basic managerial solution.
Mm-hmm.
I think time and again, I mean, this is going back to your notion of Putin as a lame duck president.
Mm-hmm.
And we have our continuing discussions about that. But what I do say...
I'll go with your lame... What was it? Lame duck double-headed eagle with long talons
eagle,
or something.
Exactly. let no metaphors be easy ones. But I think what we are seeing is, in some ways, ironically, actually a lame duck administration.
Mm.
Putin himself, as an individual, has still the same potency, the symbolic potency.
Mm.
But actually, where the people on whom he relies to manage things and get things working, I think they're experiencing greater and greater problems in knowing exactly what to do and how to do it.
Well, no, and I think they're also feeling that, yeah, the clock is basically ticking on this regime in one form or another. It can't anoint a successor. Putin's not going to live forever, and so there's a feeling of the very mortality.
Maybe there'll be a vacancy in the mausoleum.
Anna, last thoughts to you. Save us again.
Again, I don't think there's any. We can't save us from ourselves. I know, of course. No, I mean, I think that in 2012, when Putin returned for a third term, there was a sense of, okay, let's find a cohesive ideology to, you know, unify ourselves. And I think right now we've come to the conclusion that has failed. Mm-hmm. That has again disintegrated. We are again seeing a disintegrate approach to our own history. Mm-hmm. We again cannot agree on what we are. The Kremlin has given up pretense of trying to, perhaps. And maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Maybe we need to be talking about the variations, the contradictions. And maybe by going to this memorial, Putin has started that. Now, that might be...
Inadvertently,
yes. He might... That might be an end to any integration to his own legacy or regime, but that might open the way for whatever comes after to be more aware of the different components and contradictions of the history we're grappling with now.
No, I mean, one of the things I've been saying this for a while, and you probably heard me say it, is that this is a regime that's run out of stories to tell its people. And maybe that is, I think that is a good thing. Maybe it'll get us to that point where Maxim Trudolubov so incisively said in his piece that, you know, we have to deal with this history by being honest about it.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can get there, then maybe Putin just did inadvertently do Russia a favor. So I like to end on an optimistic note for once. So on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the forthcoming book, The Vori, Russia's Super Mafia, which will be published next year and which I'm really looking forward to. Also joining us in the studio has been journalist Anna Aratunyan, author of the book The Putin Mystique. Thank you both for an enlightening discussion.
And a good fun one.
And a very fun one.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer Tanya Koncheva and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFURL's Russian language program Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. The Power Vertical podcast will take a 2-week hiatus as I will be on the road attending the Warsaw Security Forum and a conference in Vilnius. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.